You're listening to The Psychedologist. This is Consciousness Positive Radio. Hello, friends. Welcome back. The second episode of a two-part series with Justice Rivera and Paola Graciela Khan of Body Autonomy, Decolonizing Sex Work and Drug Use. In this conversation, Justice, who compiled the essays and stories that make up the book, and contributor Paola, go deep into topics such as substance use, colonization, bodily sovereignty, rites of passage, sex worker-centered harm reduction, collectivity, and the importance of education to help shift paradigms. Body Autonomy is coming out May 14th, 2024. You can pre-order it from Synergetic Press at the link in the show notes. Or if it's after May 14th, 2024, hello, future persons, you can order the book at Synergetic Press as well. Justice Rivera is a writer, social justice consultant, harm reductionist, and pleasure activist based in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Justice's professional and artistic work is grounded in principles of harm reduction, anti-oppression, and healing justice. Her expressions seek to deconstruct carceral and punishment-driven paradigms to race, gender, and bodily autonomy. Justice has worked to provide direct services, organizing leadership, and capacity building to support people in the sex trade, survivors of trafficking, and people who use drugs in Denver, Washington, D.C., Seattle, and nationally. She is now a partner with Reframe Health and Justice Consulting. She is the collectrix and co-author of Body Autonomy, Decolonizing Sex Work and Drug Use. When she isn't working, Justice loves to travel, cook, volunteer, and play with her cat, friends, and family. Paola Graciela Khan is a first-generation Mayan-Iberian Ashkenazi Jewish community-based researcher, policy advocate, movement strategist, edu trainer, facilitator, herbalist, and healing arts practitioner. Paola's research investigates the roles of psychoactive substances in pluricultural contexts for processes of historical memory, accountability, reparations, reconciliation, transitional and transformative justice, demilitarization, disarmament, and reintegration. Welcome to The Psychedologist, and why don't you kick us off, Justice? What was your relationship to consciousness as a child?
You had told me that this was going to be the first question that you asked, and the first thing that I thought, actually, was that I've been doing these somatic courses to look at the relationship between trauma and some of the things I'm feeling in my body by a Latina woman who calls herself the workout witch. And a lot of what she said that really resonates with me is that those of us who have compounded trauma often can't remember our childhood. And that is a survival mechanism, right? And so I actually don't remember a lot of my childhood. But some of my early memories of starting to become aware of myself and my surroundings were when I was little, and I went to go visit some family members in a place that was kind of like wooded in Arizona, like the mountains of Arizona. And it's interesting because that place actually holds a lot of trauma for me. And so I generally don't want to think about some of those memories. However, I do remember some of my earliest memories is that I would go into the woods. And I remember feeling a profound sense of being both small and also connected to everything outside of myself. And looking back on it, I remember I would go play with my imaginary friends, but looking back on it, I'm very much like, oh, I was connected to my ancestors. I was connected to my spirit guides that were really present for me at that time. And so I do think it's really cool that some of my earliest memories, that a lot of my relationship to consciousness has been to get outside, right? To get outside myself, because I think that, actually thinking about it, you know, fast forward many years after that in my late teens, early 20s, some of the places that were hardest for me to want to be aware was actually when I was locked up in the county jail system. And so it's interesting because I can just have these memories of being like caged, like an animal, and my relationship to consciousness at that point versus when I was younger and just being outside, being the opposite of caged, right? Being outside and connected to nature and the relationship to consciousness at that point. And I think that both of those, right, I can be really tapped in, but the degree to which I want to be is very, very different, right? So, I think as a child, I can't really speak to my relationship to consciousness, but I have these memories of becoming aware of myself in the context of the world. And I actually think my next memory was under the influence of spirits. I think it was the first time that I drank alcohol. And this very much tells you about my Puerto Rican mother. And she went, and we were in Texas. We were with my really amazingly gay godfather. And my mom was like, the first time that you're going to get drunk is off of good booze and with people who love you. And I was 11 years old, and she took me to a bar, and I had one of everything that she had. And I remember trying to point out to my mother how beautiful this woman was. Right. And I just saw this, gorgeous femme. And I kept trying. I was just like, she's like, I started understanding myself and who I was. And also that I didn't feel like my mother got what I was trying to tell her. Right. And so I also had a relationship to consciousness as my queerness. Right. In a lot of ways, like queering consciousness, I think, was really prominent for me. And even as I got older and I went to a Jewish high school, and there was a very loud sense that what my sexuality was not okay. I was like the first person to come out there. And now there's actually a whole organization called Keshet that supports Jewish people who are queer in Jewish high school. But we did not have that when I was younger. And I got gay bashed by teachers. I got gay bashed by other students and all of that. But I never questioned it. I've never in my life. I've just been like, this is completely right and okay. And ever since I was a kid, and that first memory of myself, my consciousness and myself understanding that, like, I was really attracted to femininity in all its forms. And so those are two memories I really wanted to bring forward today.
Wow. Wow. That was such a great way to kick us off. Thank you so much. And I like that you said spirits before, and I was like, oh, spirits. And then you said alcohol. I'm like, right. There's a reason they call them spirits. A lot we could go into there. Okay, but how about you, Paula? What do you have to say about your relationship to consciousness?
Wow, I just want to say first, what a treat to hear my dear friend and comrade and colleague to hear Justice's memories, that full range, very real spectrum of experiences as a youth, as a child. For me, I can recall memories that were challenging in my early consciousness, as well as early memories that were curious and that were joyful. And I remember having a relationship to my dreams from a young age, especially processing my daily experiences in the dream world. And I was raised by my Guatemalan grandmother, so a lot of my early consciousness was around spending most of my time with her while my parents worked. So I have memories, for example, around her discipline and how that was a very rigid form of discipline for a child to receive. So I have memories around that. I have memories. I remember becoming conscious of the transition between being alive in the flesh and transitioning to another metaphysical state, although I didn't completely understand. And this was because I used to deliver my step-grandfather's daily morning banana. He was bedridden, and I was maybe like between a baby and a toddler or a toddler. And one morning I went to deliver the morning banana, and he didn't wake up. So I was the first one to let my grandmother know that her husband wasn't waking up. And so I have some memories of that experience and the ambulance taking him away. And I remember crying. And that was my first experience of that separation between life and death. And I have, memories around early consciousness are interesting. I also have memories of, being a curious child around sexuality and just very innocent, curious, and natural attractions to diverse beings. And since I was raised by my grandmother, I was simultaneously digesting a lot of Latina telenovelas because my grandmother watched so much Latina telenovelas. So that is deep in my early childhood consciousness, which I love to poke fun at because I must. It's just so dramatic, so full of like lies, deception, competition, sex, crime, plot twists. And so I must laugh at it all because, you know, you see how it can come up if you're socially conditioned with that kind of media. On the one hand, I was seeing very sexually charged telenovelas and I would be told to cover my eyes when like all of the like taboo parts would come on in the telenovela with like rock and roll music playing, like something wrong and stigmatized and taboo is going down. Now close your eyes, Paulita. And so I'd always be like, but I really want to see what's going on. that really fed my curiosity. And meanwhile, on the other hand, because there was limited supervision on my grandmother's upbringing of me, because my parents were working all the time, she would also take me to church. And she had converted from Catholicism to like either evangelical or Pentecostal, who knows what form of Christianity, but it was very strict. So I had to go with her to church and like religious gatherings at least 2 to 3 times a week. And I hated it. And I attribute this to like a lot of my rebellious inclinations, refusals to conform. And yeah, I just really rejected that indoctrination because I really did feel terror that there was a God that was monitoring, surveilling my thoughts, my activities. And so if I had a queer thought, I would then be like, just kidding. Like, I didn't really have that lesbian thought. I'm not a lesbian. Like, just to be clear. So yeah, just there was a lot of self-surveillance and guilt and shame in my social conditioning. So that's like some of the stuff I remember. I also remember like, you know, some psychic experiences here and there that was like, well, like, what is that? And just feeling very curious about like the degrees of consciousness within our bodies and the multiverses. I remember like being very curious about whether there were parallel realities or universes and like whether the little microorganisms within us had consciousness. But yeah, those are some of the things that I recall from early consciousness.
Oh, wow. I think this is like my favorite round of answering these questions. Just both of you, what you shared is so powerful. I'm also amazed at how many guests on this show have been raised in some way in an evangelical context, like at times or fully, especially that it's a show about mainly we're talking about sex, drugs, or both. And that's very much what the book is about that you two were part of creating. So it's just interesting how that is. And I don't know if it must be synchronicity at the very least, that so many people were in that very strict church. So this is probably a great segue into bodily autonomy and this amazing work that's being birthed very soon. Maybe even by the time this episode comes out, folks can order it. So Justice, will you say a little bit about, maybe about how this book came into being and also what it offers to even to this conversation about strictness and punishment and freedom and autonomy?
Absolutely. So I have worked in the realm of harm reduction since 2010. And I had kind of a different start than I think many people got to have, which is that I started actually in a sex worker rights organization. It actually wasn't a sex worker rights organization. It was a very liberal anti-trafficking organization that took harm reduction and anti-oppression approaches that sadly can no longer exist because of the ways in which the war on trafficking mirrors the war on drugs. And every sex worker harm reduction program I know uses drug and substance harm reduction, but not vice versa. In fact, very few substance-centered or even anti-violence programs, I think, really know about sex worker-centered harm reduction. And so all the work that we did was really kind of intertwining and intersectional and at the margins all of the time. But as someone who is a former drug user who spent time cycling through the county jail system, and is also a former sex worker. Like, I really was in these spaces wanting to support people who, maybe I did not have a lot of knowledge growing up. I did not have harm reduction knowledge, and I wanted people who were still using, who were young like me, to be able to have the knowledge I didn't have. And I really started to see that there is this movement, right, of the war on sex trafficking mimicking the war on drugs, and was really frightened that it didn't really feel like this was in a lot of people's consciousness, that people were really seeing or understanding this, and that it had the same kind of insidious narrative, right, of like, well, we want to actually help people, but all these policies are creating the problems that they claim to be addressing, right? And so I really wanted to be able to raise awareness of these issues, and had an opportunity to do that when I was awarded a Open Society Foundation Soros Justice Media Fellowship to write this book. And it, what became, actually, I was going to write a narrative nonfiction, but I realized I have a memoir in me, and my agent is actually currently trying to pitch that and publish that. And so I'm excited that hopefully is forthcoming. But I also thought mine is just one story, and I know all these amazing people, and also that we haven't really gotten to hear a lot of BIPOC voices on these topics, even though harm reduction truly comes from BIPOC people, especially in the sex trade, right? Harm reduction in the sex trade started from trans women of color in urban cities who were still to this day experience the highest rate of murder in the sex trade, who started being like, hey, maybe I should just like pass around information about these clients who have been hurting trans women out here. And that practice of a bad date list continues today, right, in a variety of different forms. And so these are interventions, these are care practices that are coming from communities of color, and I really wanted to hear from those communities and what those look like today. And so I really think that body autonomy is really beautiful, and that it's both really tangible and practical, but also really visionary and transformational. And it kind of moves that way in the way that you read it, and providing really kind of concrete information about the basic mechanics of the sex trade, looking at a timeline of all of the ways in which the wars on bodily autonomy essentially have the same goal of population control and also maintaining federal powers, right? And we can really see that when we look at this timeline and the ways that these all look, and that ultimately it's all about trying to keep out the immigrant, which became now controlling people of color and trying to subjugate people of color. And that actually working on that timeline was really illuminating even to me working on it, right? Just really understanding, like, gosh, this all has the same root and the same purpose, but because of the non-profitization of our social justice movements, we've been pitted against each other. And I remember being at a Drug Policy Alliance conference, the one in Denver, I think that was 2014. And I heard several people say, like, oh, why are we arresting people for drugs? We should be arresting like pimps and prostitutes, right? And I was just like, And I think there becomes this, and I think, I think especially those of us from communities of color understand this, right? I think especially a lot of Latinx people, there's a lot of colorism in, a lot of groups that are always like, well, but them, and we kind of push it off on other marginalized people. And I think I see that happening in our social justice, right? Where people are like, oh, well, you know, hey, a criminalization off me, but like go over there and look at that one. Really, it's all the same state tactics, and it's all of us, right? And I think we've really experienced that. It's being able to have progress in certain areas, and it really hasn't had the impact necessarily that we wanted to have, like the legalization of marijuana, right? And so that's a lot of what the book is really lifting up. It's really looking towards a paradigm shift and understanding how really the ways that people are seeking to expand consciousness and the ways that people are experiencing state violence are all really, really connected. And so ultimately, if we can understand that, and if we can band together to fight a bigger fight, perhaps rather than a battle, that we might be able to get collective liberation in the way that we're all seeking.
Yes. Paula, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. And in that spirit, I'd like to talk about these ideological wars on bodily autonomy from, trying to control people's bodies today and tracing that to the embodied colonization of people. And that's what my co-author Ismail Ali and I seek out to do in the chapter entitled An Eco-Futurist Prayer for Breaking Intergenerational Curses. And in this chapter, we start with a prayerful poem that's for all the generations. And it's also very much for the youth, because we come into this world as children, as young people, and you know, we're born with curiosity, and historically in, pre-contact traditional societies, there's often rites of passage through which people learn from the elders in their community in how to relate to each other, how to relate to oneself. And because of colonization and historic mass violence, which has led to intergenerational historical trauma, some of us don't have access to these rites of passage, and yet we still are curious beings. And because we've been socially conditioned through these legacies of historic mass violence, we, instead of receiving guidance around how to navigate our budding sexuality, or, you know, sometimes it's a very human thing to seek altered states of consciousness. You know, if you think about things that kids sometimes do, like maybe sniffing a marker or being attracted to certain little things, or like, you know, running around in circles and spinning, we are attracted to altered states of consciousness. We're curious beings innately. And yet we're not provided with the culturally appropriate tools that will guide us through that. Instead, we experience punishment, we experience stigmatization, and without culturally relevant early sexuality education, we also are at risk of having our bodily autonomy violated from a young age. And so there's all of these ideological wars which have which create risk factors in our early lives, and those create to disproportionate health outcomes. Something I think about that doesn't get touched in the book per se, but it's very much in the spirit of the conversations that different authors contribute, is that we are not talking enough about the relationship between survivorship and initiation around substance use. But the book really shows a clear line that there is a relationship between sexuality, sex work, and dismantling the war on drugs. And that's really what I love about this anthology, that Justice brought together folks from both the world of sex worker rights advocacy and also from the movement to dismantle the war on drugs. And this anthology is such a prayer to that, where we're talking about our real experiences. And even if someone isn't speaking to the sex worker experience explicitly in the book, there are many ways that sex workers are front and center in this anthology. And just wanting to mention and also feeling very spirited to uplift the work of Shira Hassan in Saving Our Own Lives, because that's one of the big premises of the anthology that Shira Hassan put together. And I just see both of these anthologies as being in dialogue with each other, because harm reduction work, drug policy work, the movement for psychedelic research and therapy is not talking enough about the experiences of survivors of sexual violence and gender-based violence, and also the lives of sex workers. And yet, sex workers are the ones who have guided us through the past 50 plus years of revolutionary movement and yet become invisibilized.
Wow. Oh, my heart is beating fast with just like resonance and excitement and juiciness. Thank you for mentioning Shira Hassan. I love her work so much. And the cast of characters, the authors in this book are such badasses, such wise, beautiful, amazing people. I don't know if you want to speak anything to that, Justice, just the collection. It's a collection of voices, truly, that you put together.
Yeah, I'm really grateful that so many of these people are my friends, right? Or I'm in community with. And one of the things that was really exciting, so kind of the journey of this book, I've learned so much. I'm the type of person who really builds a plane while flying it, you know? So I really didn't know anything about publishing. And we actually had created kind of a former version of this book called Toward Bodily Autonomy that was self-published at the beginning of 23. And we did really well, right? And I think that was really awesome. And now I'm really excited that we are under Synergetic Press and have the opportunity to be in bookstores and just to have a broader conversation. We have new articles. And so this body autonomy is really just a really amazing evolution of that work. But one of the things that I heard when we had Towards Bodily Autonomy and we were doing a book reading was that the bookstore owner at Moon Palace Books, which is like an abolitionist bookstore in Minneapolis, said, you know, this is really amazing to hear new voices discussing harm reduction and abolition and, really, really kind of a vision for a safe world for all of us. And because we've heard, I think, a lot of the most amazing voices, you know, building up from Miriam Kava to Andrew Ritchie to Shira Hassan. And I think that there's so many more people who are doing this work that I'm really excited to hear from. And it's not just activists, right? It's also healers. Rochelle Faithful, I think the last article in the book, I think, was really amazing. I think that there's really just a broad array of people who are doing the work in their area who are working to bridge all of this, right? And from policy to direct services to media work. And so I think it's really just an amazing cast of characters, like you said.
You know, you're so right about like an abolitionist now and future. And I feel like to call that in, it was so important to tell the history. And the history in this book was I was learning, like, and it's like, I consider myself to know probably more about these things than the average person, especially things in the matters of drugs and psychedelics. But also I have friends that are working for sex worker rights. I have friends that are sex workers. I feel, you know, I've had sex workers on the podcast. I feel relatively familiar, but there was just so much to learn and to see the parallels between these histories. So I just wanted to offer thanks for that among many other things that I got to learn from the book. But yeah, also Paula, what you commented on that I wanted to lift up as well was voices of survivors, rites of passage. These are things that, I don't know if I had to guess why they don't get centered as much. I think it's just the great a wounding and then like a distancing from this wounding instead of like looking at it and moving towards it. I think people just are defended and And I'm so saddened by that, but then also heartened by those who do uplift those voices and narratives and just the reality of, yeah, of all that colonization has taken away from us that we need to reclaim.
Okay. Yeah, I actually just want to run with the we don't really center survivors enough kind of, I think, theme really that Paola is putting forward, because I recently became a survivor member of the Freedom Network USA, who are the anti-carceral, anti-trafficking people, anti-human trafficking people. And there's really a divide among the trafficking movement, which was very much a top-down movement. It was very different than the domestic violence movement, which was a kind of still can be very carceral, right? But it was very like bottom up. And that is not the case with the anti-trafficking movement. It's very much like a legal concept that then kind of trickled down. And then the people, the academics and the policymakers who were doing all of that were like, well, we really need to uplift survivors. And the way that that's happened in and of itself has been really exploitative and kind of screwed up. But because of that, also, there has been people with a certain ideological viewpoint, right, which is generally that all sex work is exploitative, going to find people who are just fresh out of their exploitative situations, or oftentimes fresh out of like prostitution court or jail, and, you know, kind of indoctrinating them into a specific pathway. And so because there's an anti-prostitution pledge, right, there's not really the ability to put a lot of harm reduction orientation information in front of people. People are overwhelmingly kind of getting plugged into a certain pathway. And that can be really frustrating to see. But through Freedom Network, and there's some other, the National Survival Network, there's really starting to be a growing network of survivors of human trafficking who take rights-based approaches to sex work and trafficking and law just in general, and the programs that we have around us. And the experience of it, the other type of anti-trafficking organizations telling us and members of this, like survivors who can really kind of place their experience in the context of, you know, what we see going on around us in a certain sociopolitical context, being told that like we're still traumatized and that's why we're saying the things we are, that we don't really know, that we're actually just kind of like, quote unquote, happy hookers, that we don't actually have these experiences. And so that can be really frustrating when we come forward with that and then are told essentially our experiences aren't good enough. I had that happen with me recently when I was a expert witness in the trafficking case. And, you know, I was basically told like, oh, well, your experiences, though trafficking, were not really similar to these victims' experiences in this case. And like, does it matter? I'm the only survivor you've ever had up here talking, right? And so those things are just really interesting. And so I think that there's just so many ways in which survivors in particular and survivor stories are discounted and silenced. And so I think that I'd really, you know, this book is one format, but in general, I'm really excited to hear and see and be part of survivor movements that are working towards a vision for safety that really can center the needs of the most marginalized and not rely on an exploitative and violent criminal justice system, criminal legal system, because there's no way that we are going to end violence and exploitation with violence and exploitation, right? And so I think that there's people who are working on that and other people are really afraid, but if anyone does think that they have any of these experiences, I really encourage them to check out Freedom Network USA and the National Survivors Network. I know that there's also a lot of DV survivor networks that are like that. I'd like to see us all work together. But I really appreciate, Paola, you being able to uplift that today.
Yeah. And to go off of that, I want to name that my understanding, the way I observe and the way that I read the structural violence that has been designed to keep folks oppressed and pipelined into victimization by misogynist patriarchal violence, is that colonization persists today in the ways that people are denied their basic survival needs, so that some folks have limited options for how they can survive. And yet, because people are resilient, they will find ways to survive. But many of those ways are criminalized, because then people profit off of the ways folks are pipelined to survive through the structural violence. So I like, as someone who has experienced economic instability for whatever reason, you know, there are ways in which I have chosen to exert autonomy over my body. But because of the ways that some of those activities are criminalized, I've had limited legal recourse for when I am harmed because of the economic activities I've chosen to participate in. So then the system that is supposed to protect and serve me under the guise of law enforcement actually is not serving me because of the way that I chose to survive. And yet there is gender-based violence that I'm experiencing while I'm attempting to survive and thrive. So there are many flaws by design in the systems of public safety, the systems and structures of public safety, and those who are disproportionately experiencing the failures of public safety and law enforcement are trans people of color, trans Black folks. And there's a lot of also LGBTQ folks, because of the violence that LGBTQ folks face within their own families and their communities. There's disproportionate amounts of LGBTQI youth who are unhoused and who are runaways, et cetera, et cetera. Something I wanted to share is this quote from Shira Hassan's Saving Our Own Lives, which is also in this spirit of being survivor-centered and, calling on our movements to be more survivor-centered and rooted in addressing gender-based violence. So this is in Shira Hassan's words. "I will not be regaling you with the wonders and horrors of what it is like, was like to be involved in sex work as a teen and adult. Nobody with life experience trading sex for money, whether due to force, for pleasure, or for economics, should have to recount their experiences in order that others recognize the basic principles of body autonomy and reproductive justice." And I feel like more of us, need to be exploring and experimenting how to support survivors in being able to come out as survivors, because I think that is just such a strong part of why we're experts and why we should be consulted with and why we should be granted leadership within movements. And yet it's not easy to come out as a survivor of violence and to also acknowledge that survivorship has, you know, an impact on our mental health, neurodivergency, and other things that we carry. But, you know, exploring how to create those spaces where folks can find strength in publicly identifying as a survivor without having to divulge the details of how they survived.
Right. Yeah, that's a whole other part to it. When someone in a previous episode spoke to that, folks can feel like they have to tell about something extremely traumatizing to them in order to be taken seriously, or for like the harm that they've experienced to be like validated as harm. And that creates a whole other problematic condition. That was Kai Cheng Tom talking about that. Justice, something that you said is still ringing with me, and I wonder if we can revisit this some more together, either of you. There's no way we're going to end violence and exploitation with violence and exploitation. So I'm just thinking, I'm thinking about the carceral system, and that was the context that you meant it in. But I think I'm also I can't help but think about current events and what's going on in the world and just how true this is to that as well, and how that relates to bodily autonomy. we're all just shaking our heads and making faces right now. Because no one can see us except us. So just saying that for the listeners.
So I currently live in occupied U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, Taino land. And the ways in which Puerto Ricans who have tried to resist Puerto Rican nationalists throughout the years have been killed is really insidious. In particular, radiation poisoning is how everyone kind of went out, right? The U.S. imprisoned some of our most famous nationalists, the like fathers and mothers of the nationalist movement, and then gave them like low-key radiation poisoning until they died. And you don't really see the same spirit of like freedom that we used to have, because in a lot of ways people were just scared enough to come in the line, and of course there's activist movements here and all of that, right? But I think that in when people have to survive under extreme conditions of poverty, of colonization, there are, I just don't think that it's really unthinkable that people would want to, kind of make different moves for freedom. But everyone has different pathways, right? Like Malcolm X and MLK were two freedom activists who had very different approaches. But one of those is, of course, lifted up a lot more than another. It's, I think, in society. But ultimately, right, like people have different approaches for that. But to conflate everyone, right, just has a shared identity, to say that everyone therefore must have the same ideology, and to be in a position of power and to be the colonizer ultimately, to then punch back a million, like after being pinched, right? Like a million times more is, I think, just really reprehensible. And I think that there's been a lot of really interesting like phenomenons that I've seen happen after that. I mean, to start, the opposite of Palestinian is not Jewish, right? And I really think that I've seen a huge kind of backlash in a lot of ways, where I think that, you know, not everyone who's in Israel is for the genocide that's happening. And I mean, Israel makes it really hard to actually stand up against that, right? Like, people are forced into the military industrial complex. And I talked about greenwashing, right, in a certain context earlier. And so I think that one of the things that I've just been really, that happens when there is so much violence that is in particular, right, like, or not in particular, that those of us, right, who are in the U.S. or U.S. affiliates, like, don't agree with, right, but are the people who are in power are making decisions for us that are against our best interest. We feel powerless in this situation, right? We can protest, we can send GoFundMes to Palestinian families, we can do all of that, but there is a shared feeling of powerlessness. I think that those of us experience, and probably a lot of Israelis too, who are ultimately not in agreement with the ways in which our governments are acting. And I think that experience of powerlessness makes us lose sight of nuances and context, and to really be able to have a lot of empathy. And I think that it's created some really intense divisions and generalizations. And so what I'm trying to do is remain open and to people pointing out those nuances and context to me, right? Because I don't know all of it, to being able to have that conversation. But I think that what happens when we're in the midst of such horrific genocide that is so close yet also so far, that we want to be able to reverse and have an impact on is that we, as that I think people kind of close off. And I've just been really scared about seeing what has been happening in social justice movements, within social justice movements in the U.S. In reaction to this, because I think it's really just been very divisive.
Yeah, I hear that. I as someone who is Jewish, Ashkenazi Jewish, and Mayan and Iberian, I feel a responsibility to extend patience to some people that others may not have the capacity to engage with. And I'm reminded the more that I try to practice extending my window of tolerance to engage with folks that are acting out and speaking from a place of historical trauma, I myself learn more that I do not know enough to. There are some things that I can say with conviction and with certainty, such as there shouldn't be any type of military draft ever. I can say that with certainty. I can say with certainty that there should be no sexual violence used as a weapon of war ever, and that children and civilians must never be targeted. And for me, those are non-negotiables. And so when I extend my window of tolerance to engaging with folks that I don't necessarily want to be engaging with, but because we have diverging views, I'm also reminded that I do not know enough, and I don't think any of us have the capacity to know enough human history to account for all of the massacres and instances of historical mass violence that someone is carrying in their own memory because of their own lineages, because of their own access to education. And so that's the complexity I'm sitting in right now, is that there's just so much human history that I can't carry alone. But I think if we can all understand that intergroup massacres are so intrinsic to human history, how can we stop them from continuing to be a part of human history? Like, we must work together, because there is that shared grief of knowing the intimacy of losing someone that is part of your group, your family. I was trying to, last week, before I went to sleep, I prayed to ask to understand why this is happening, why there is genocide happening, genocide by the ethnostate of Israel towards Palestinians, why there's intergroup mass violence. And the dream I had that night was that I was with a coworker, and I was in my grandparents' house, and at the door to my grandparents' room, my grandparents were refugees from Germany. They fled during the Holocaust. At the door to my grandparents' room, there was a guy with a group of other guys, and he was speaking horribly about my grandparents. And it triggered this very primal response within me where I started beating this guy up, and I couldn't control my violence towards him. I was very upset that he was speaking ill of my grandparents. And when I finally realized that I had exerted so much violence over him, I felt extreme guilt and shame, and I was just apologizing profusely. And in my dream, my coworker had also acted from her subconscious. And then we were both crying after, because we felt out of control in the moment when we acted, and then we were crying about it after. And so that, to me, just tells me that a lot of folks, there is a certain part of us that's acting from a place of deep unconscious. And so I think about how the structural factors such as the military draft and the training that people undergo, the social conditioning in childhood, because people are taught to normalize the conditions that they're living under, that combined with a deep memory of ancestral suffering through historic mass violence is a recipe for dehumanization of people that bring feelings associated with existential threats. So yeah, I'm feeling like we have so many open wounds and the structural factors are not working towards healing those deep psychic wounds. They're exacerbating the wounds that we have, deepening those wounds. And I think people should have the freedom to choose where their resources go. Our public resources are propping up these military drafts, both here in the US and abroad in Israel, because we're not provided with access to our fundamental survival necessities. Instead, here in the US, people are forced to sign up for the military because it might guarantee some kind of economic stability in the future for cash poor people. And abroad in Israel, it's just mandatory. And that's where a lot of dehumanization is normalized, is further normalized. And because everyone in Israel who is Israeli is coerced into serving in the military, that also perpetuates this this role as a settler colonizer. Because I know of folks that because people have served in the military, they are categorized as a colonizer, as a settler. And there's many reasons why folks get categorized as a settler and colonizer. And yet there's also people who are Mizrahi Jews who had to flee their homelands in the region because of being targeted as members of a group that was excluded from the dominant group ruling that territory. So there's just so many overlapping complex histories. And I think the first thing we need to do is address the structural factors that are waging war on people's bodily autonomy over how their resources are allocated, how their time, how their bodies are coerced to behave.
I also wanted to add, I think that I would like to be able to really help people understand how this issue is really connected to them. One of my best friends organizes a lot of the protests in DC right now. And she was telling me how they originally had taken a strategy, and she was not a part of this particular protest, but they had gone to northeastern DC, which is a area that is predominantly Black. It has a lot of poverty, and they blockaded traffic to be able to say, like, you know, Biden stops sending money over there and spending money on this war. And as they were doing that, I mean, there was a lot of people who were really mad, but they were poor people who were trying to get to work, right? And there was a woman who was walking behind her at some point, and they had a chant that they were doing with Biden stop funding this. And the woman was walking behind her, and she was like, I can't care about things that are happening over there because I can't eat. And the fact is that that money, our money, our tax money, all of that is going over there instead of our social service safety net, right? That we are funding a war instead of being able to support people here in the United States who are experiencing immense amounts of violence every day. Like, our public safety system is horrible. Our social service system is also horrible, right? And so we like are really, I think we have a duty to be able to work with people to help them understand, right, that this, the way that we are playing right globally right now has a very local impact, right? And I think that to some people, I mean, I'd love to see us do more education around that, right? But we have so much that is needed. And like Paola was saying, I think the systemic barriers are really great. And as someone who did appropriation work, I did HIV hepatitis C appropriation work on the federal level for 2 years. Like, I really believe that a lot of it starts with appropriation, addressing systemic barriers where we are sending funding and not sending funding. Is really where, like, literally the buck stops, right?
And to just add to what you're saying, because we're seeing that play out locally here in Los Angeles and also across the state of California, right now, the state of California is in a quote-unquote deficit. So we don't have enough funds to actually implement some of the previous funding that had been allocated to behavioral health interventions. And, you know, right now, nationally, we're facing the overdose crisis, the opioid overdose epidemic. It's an epidemic. And so there had been multi-year funding that had been earmarked for behavioral interventions to support people on the front lines of poverty, behavioral health, substance use disorders. And now there's not enough money for that. And there's not enough money for the housing funding that had been previously committed. And here in Los Angeles, we've never seen such public health crises compound on top of each other, where the housing crisis, the overdose epidemic, it's all overlapping. And the unhoused population is a population with some of the higher rates of overdose-related deaths. And so what that tells me, and we recently had our mayor say that because of the state deficit, we're also going to have a city deficit here in LA. And yet the LA mayor will not publicly support a ceasefire. And so that just tells me it's so obvious that our federal funding, our federal appropriations processes are failing us, because then our government, our state governments and our city governments are saying we don't have enough money to take care of people. And yet there's silence when it comes to denouncing how our public resources are used for war. It's wild.
Since I have a second on air, because I feel like people don't so many people don't even understand Puerto Rico is currently occupied by the U.S. Like, the amount of times that TSA agents tell me I need a passport, I just become the angry Puerto Rican, right? I'm just like, what? But so the rate of poverty here in Puerto Rico is 26 times higher than the poorest state in the contiguous U.S., which is Mississippi. 26 times higher. And we are currently colonized. We have no opportunity to really be able to change the economic situation of the islands, but we are in debt to the United States. And after Maria, which really changed the whole economic landscape of the islands, I mean, people here talk about pre and post Maria. Like, that's how we measure time, right? And after that, there was a U.S. control board, La Promesa, that was instituted to basically try, that is, none of them were Puerto Ricans at all. No one who even really has a vested interest in Puerto Rico was created to try to, quote unquote, like, change the economic and to pay off Puerto Rico's debt. Now, since 1917, there has been the Jones Act, which says that no goods coming into any U.S. territories can come from anywhere except the United States. And so even though in times of crisis, like, we have a huge power problem here in the U.S. and or here in Puerto Rico, and there are tons of backup generators that are usually diesel fueled. And after hurricanes or times of crisis, when we run out of fuel, there are ships from Colombia. They're ready to bring us fuel, but we have to wait on the island for weeks without power until it can be routed through the U.S. And then we have to pay for the cost of all that travel and where it comes from. And if the Jones Act was removed, right, and it's the same union bodies that are, you know, this, that it's union bodies that are stopping this, labor union bodies. But if the Jones Act was removed, U.S., Puerto Rico would be out of debt like that. But instead, La Promesa has said, we're going to cut all public funding to Puerto Rico by 60%. All of our public health funding, all of our education funding, all of our just everything, all of our public funding has been cut by 60%. And so, you know, whenever I have the opportunity, I love to really tell people about, like, what it is, right? This systemic functioning looks like, because it's not sound, right? Like, it all really is based on, you know, supporting kind of private interests and a certain type of person who's in power. And so I think that, again, this is what colonization really looks like, right? And these are the systemic problems that could be so easily fixed. Paul is saying, if we just could, you know, stop killing people with their money, we could actually be, like, supporting people and saving lives in the U.S. But, like, we just don't have sound policy. And so, you know, I think that
we're doing everything we can to raise awareness of this. And I appreciate the space on a podcast to do that. That's why we put out Body Autonomy. This is why every single one of us does the work that we do. And I think all of it is going to add up. I think the ways that we can decolonize, I think are systemic, and that's really important. But systemic change is very, very hard to make. And so kind of going back to a comment I said earlier, I really think that focusing on education and I think that media is a huge part of that, but being able to shift paradigms and ultimately, you know, like the next generations, right? Like I really, some days I'm really, really excited for the youth, but I also have a 14-year-old stepson, and some days I'm just like, what is going to happen in the future? I think that there's a lot of opportunity to work with the youth and to work on education and to make media around this, and all of that are forms of resistance.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both so much. And shout out to Paola being patient with people that are at a different place of understanding current events, and, you know, that the folks who are doing that emotional labor, like, that is so important. And for the folks that are done doing that emotional labor, like, you can be done and you don't have to do it. But I personally, when I have the resources to do it, I feel like it's a good job. You know, it's a worthy job. Oi, does anyone want to add anything before we kind of close out with our consciousness hacks, what you do to get in touch with your consciousness? Any last things on all this stuff that we were talking about? And I'll just say, I do agree, Justice, that education is huge for shifting paradigms. And part of me was like, oh, wow, this is like a really heavy way to end this episode. And like, how am I going to, I guess part of me was feeling a responsibility to like make it hopeful or nice. And then I feel like really this book is the hopefulness and the niceness. Like this is what this carries, the hope and prayer for this is that whoever can get their hands on this book will be changed by it. It definitely had a big impact on me. And I endorsed it. And I think I said, like, this should be required reading for anyone in any industry at all. Anyone. But yeah, so do you want to share with us something that you do to get in touch with your consciousness now these days?
Yeah, sure, I'll start. I've had a really hard, probably the last couple, like since September 2020 has been until probably like September, I mean, still kind of, but till September 23, really, were the hardest times of my life. And I've, you know, like been through a lot, but a lot of it is because there has been just really inescapable interpersonal violence, and moving like 7,000 miles away made it feel a little more escapable, but it's still there, right? And but when I was closer to it, it felt really insurmountable, and I there were days I just couldn't get off my floor. And this was actually in the middle of writing, right, a Body Autonomy, right? And it was just really hard to try to separate, like find hopefulness in those dark spaces. And I think a lot of times, like writing did that for me, right? And being able to work with the other co-authors and actually focus on my past, because I was writing a memoir, and try to not let like what was happening come into it. And one day I'll write that story. It doesn't really have an end, but I actually think Paola and I have actually talked about wanting to co-write a Choose Your Own Adventure revenge fantasy. So it's one day we're going to do that. But I think one of the things that really became kind of like consciousness hack that I needed in a time of feeling so unsafe was micro and mini dosing substances. And from psilocybin to ketamine to even Adderall, I mean, taking larger doses of things was, kind of just lending itself to my panic state, or I wasn't like ready for it. It really just exasperated a lot of the like issues I was feeling, because I could not see hope in those times. Someone told me that micro mini dosing is actually the divine feminine energy. Because if we are taking full doses, that's, you know, that's like an active push towards something, right? And that's a very masculine energy, which is amazing, right? In a lot of ways. But the more intuitive, kind of slow, care-based approach can be micro and mini dosing in a way that sometimes we don't even feel it, right? Or we feel it in a way that's really accessible to the place that we're at in that moment. And so I'm still today, that's something that I'm doing, and I have to be really intentional and prepared. I think everyone should be intentional, prepared, you know, if they can, for their substance use, even if that's like a daily, I'm getting well today and I want to be prepared for this. I'm in the right mind for this, and, you know, at least try to have the most like sterile process that I can for getting well, right? Like, I think all of us can do that. But I think that for me, it's really to say, okay, this is where I'm at, really recognizing that, and say, like, I can find all sorts of different healing aids, and this has worked for me in the past, and I don't have to do it like I did before. You know, I don't always have to go to the jungle and do ayahuasca to like access my healing. And so for me, I think that my consciousness hack recently, and for anyone who's feeling unsafe, I'll say, you know, maybe this is something you consider, is what does the divine feminine in your healing practice look like? And for me, that like growing in mini dosing.
Wow. Thank you. I'm going to think about that. And I resonated with a lot of what you said there. How about you, Paola?
Yeah, for me, it's been, I've been thinking about things in terms of collecting brain cells, because there's been memes that have entered the internet about making jokes about how someone is like on their last brain cell, or like when they're depleted of serotonin, et cetera, et cetera, and that it has like some funny image. And for me, that's very relatable as I've moved through living with complex PTSD. And so now I think of ways as how can I collect my happy hormones? And I envision myself running through a field, harvesting happy brain cells. And I've learned in my later 20s, and now I'm 30, I've learned that it is truly through getting a full night's rest and feeding myself and really being in deep relationship with what I'm putting into my body that is conducive to me being able to harvest those happy brain cells. And thinking about it as like harvesting the happy brain cells, like it motivates me to do the things that I know are gonna bring that. And so for me, that's movement practices. It's I do love like high intensity cardio stuff. I love hiking, but I find the most joy in erotic dancing and connecting to my sexuality through dance. And at this point in my life, I can access that in my room, in a private place. Like, I don't need to convince myself that I need to go out to a club or to a warehouse party, although like I might access it there, but I'm finding the accessibility to happen when the sun is setting, putting on some music and entering into those trance flow states through dance have been bringing me joy. Also sometimes there's songs. I have been practicing my singing. So it's those activities that are really bringing me life. And I just really want to also talk about gardening and food autonomy and how tending to gardens and from the point of sowing something in the soil and then watching it grow, feeding it and observing how rainwater and sunlight bring forth this food that we then get to put into our bodies has also transformed my relationship to food. And so really leaning into the cultivation and cooking process as a source of healing and as a source of slowing me down has been really helpful. Just thinking of the ways in which I can deepen my own mindful therapeutic practice in what sustains life. And that's been food.
Yes. And there's going to be a new guest coming in the next few months talking about food sovereignty and all of that good stuff. So this feels really a good segue. Thank you both so very much. Would you like to share with the listeners how they can find you or support your projects? And I'll put this all in the show notes as well, but just so we speak it out.
Yeah, I'm on Instagram as @justriveraunderscorewrites. I'm not super on Twitter anymore. I refuse to call it X, but I'm @justice_rights on there. And I have a writer website where you can find out more about body autonomy. And especially because body autonomy is going to be published on May 14th. You can pre-order your copy now through Synergetic Press, but we'll be doing some kind of virtual launch and some online virtual conversations that people can catch, as well as some local book launches in person. And so I'll be putting all that on my website, which is www.justiceforbearrights.com, as well as my Instagram. And Synergetic Press will be putting some of those things out as well. So I encourage folks to follow us, and hopefully I will get to meet folks in person at one of these upcoming book launches.
And folks can find me, Paula, on Instagram @FleurProductions. And my website is cosmovisioneshealing.org. That's spelled COSMOVISIONES healing.org.
Highly recommend supporting and checking out both of these fine humans' work. And thank you both again. And you're welcome back anytime, Paula. This was your second time. Maybe we make it a third next year.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us, Leah. It's always a pleasure. And it's so lovely to flow with you.
Yeah. Thank you for this opportunity. It's been so nice to meet you. And Paula, it's always amazing to be in conversation with you, dear friend. And I just really appreciate sharing this space with you too.
Thank you for listening to The Psychedologist. You can find us online at thepsychedologist.com and on Instagram. The content provided in this podcast is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not a substitute for medical or therapeutic advice or an endorsement of the illegal use of substances in your applicable jurisdiction. Any discussions regarding such substances are purely informational, cultural, and for the purpose of understanding cultural contexts, historical perspectives, and psychological phenomena. The podcast assumes no responsibility or liability for the accuracy or completeness of the content provided in any episode or by any third-party materials or sites referenced. We encourage our listeners to approach these topics with an open mind and critical thinking. Please seek guidance from qualified professionals regarding any personal concerns or issues related to mental health, substance use, and well-being.